You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
50 years ago, the economist Paul Samuelson quipped that the stock market had forecast 9 of the last 5 recessions. There are quite a few predictions of that caliber. Dewey defeats Truman, the British will vote to remain in the EU, Donald Trump will not win the GOP nomination, and we'll see if the Cubs will actually win the World Series. In Super Forecasting, the Art and Science of Prediction, Philip E. Tetlock and Dan Gardner examine why some amateurs do better than the experts in getting things right. Their book is now available in a paperback edition from Broadway Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Philip Tetlock, a political psychologist at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So do you care to make a prediction for 2 weeks from today?
Well, the prediction markets and the poll aggregators like Nate Silver are pretty clear. It's somewhere north of 90% likelihood that Hillary Clinton will be the first female president of the United States.
And Nate Silver, who has a pretty good track record, and other analysts all predicted that Donald Trump would not be the GOP candidate. Are political forecasts like that especially prone to error?
The further out in time you try to predict, the harder it gets. I think the Nate Silver incident you're referring to, I think someone asked him about the chances Donald Trump had somewhere around May or June of 2015, shortly after Trump announced his candidacy. And I think he said something of the sort that it would be probably south of 5%. And he may have added a comment of the sort, the percentage of Americans who will take this candidacy seriously would be about the same as a percentage who think the moon landings were faked.
They also were predicting that Sanders wasn't going to do nearly as well as he did. Do those things illustrate the points that you're making in this book?
Not necessarily, because even very well-calibrated forecasters are sometimes going to be wrong. So if you've got a weather forecaster who says there's a 70% likelihood of rain and it doesn't rain, you don't say, the guy's an idiot, I'm never going to listen to him again.
Oh, I do.
Well, a better idea is to say, well, what's the guy's overall track record? And he's making a lot of predictions over extended periods of time. And when he says 70% likelihood of rain, when he does that, does it rain about 70% of the time? And if it does, he's pretty darn well calibrated. And that means 30% of the time it's not going to rain, even though he's close to perfectly calibrated.
What are the prediction markets that you mentioned a moment ago?
They agree with the poll aggregators. There's not too much difference between them now.
If there is a surprise in 2 weeks, how might the experts respond? Aren't popular experts loath to admit that they are wrong?
Oh, a lot of people will fall off their chairs if Donald Trump wins. It will require rewriting some basic ideas about electoral politics in the United States.
On the other hand, in the sciences, isn't a failed prediction often as important or even more so than a successful one?
It sure is. One of the wonderful features of the best forecasters we studied in the work we did with U.S. intelligence community was their willingness to acknowledge error and to do what we call postmortems on their forecasting failures.
Most of the experts rely on polls when they're forecasting things like elections.
That's true.
So have we changed our methods on polling in recent years because they have often turned out to be wrong?
Well, the polls do sometimes fail. The Brexit was a failure of more of the pundits than of the polls. I mean, the polls were saying Brexit was very close. The pundits, who tend to hang out, tended to be people who hung out with other people who thought it was a good idea for Britain to stay in the EU and lived in a kind of ideological echo chamber. I think they were more blindsided. So I see Brexit as somewhat of a cautionary tale about giving more weight to the harder evidence and less weight to your subjective impressions.
But you bring up an important point that the pundits often hang out with people of like mind.
That is risky.
If people have said to me, "Well, I've asked all my friends about who's going to win this election, and they predict George McGovern."
Right. I remember the McGovern stories. I'm old enough to remember the McGovern stories from 1972. Yeah, absolutely.
Are experts in popular media doing prediction, or are they just providing something more like entertainment?
Well, it's a funny mixture of the two. They certainly, political pundits in particular, certainly want to sound as though they know something about the future that ordinary mortals don't know. So that puts pressure on them to say things that sound rather confident and informative. So they might say something like, well, I think Putin's next move is going to be on Estonia, or there's a distinct possibility Putin's going to move on Estonia next year.
And when it doesn't happen, we've forgotten by then.
And if it doesn't happen, they can say, well, I just said it was possible. And if it does happen, they can say, I told you, I have a distinct possibility.
After the failures that followed the 2003 invasion of Iraq, many supporters of invasion argued that they'd had reservations and that they'd been misled. Is that a common response to forecasting failures?
Very common. Iraq WMD disaster as I think one of the reasons why the intelligence community decided to start sponsoring forecasting tournaments. I think it's very much to the credit of U.S. government agencies that are willing to sponsor activities that have the potential to be embarrassing.
Well, we had a whole bunch of experts come on our show and said that that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction, but it didn't seem to change the forecasts.
It's really hard to recap.
Hans Blick was on the show, for example. Scott Ritter.
Mm-hmm. It is very, very hard to recapture past states of ignorance. There were some very smart, well-connected, informed people who were saying very unlikely. There were some very smart, well-informed people who were saying very likely. And Saddam was behaving suspiciously. And so what was the true probability before that? How should a reasonable person have processed those probabilities? And I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what the answer to that is. But I think we can say with reasonable confidence that when former director of the CIA, George Tenet, said something like slam dunk, Mr. President, that was overconfidence.
And after these predictions turn out not to be true, are there people who go back and try to understand why?
The very best forecasters do excruciatingly close postmortems of the sources of their failure.
You mentioned forecasting tournaments. What are they?
Well, forecasting tournaments are level playing field competitions in which amateurs can compete against professionals to see who can do a better job assigning realistic probabilities to events that are important. In the case of the forecasting tournaments supported by the U.S. intelligence community, they were asking questions about things like they were all foreign affairs. It was questions about whether the Eurozone would hold together, whether the Greeks would bolt from the EU, whether Assad would cling to power in 2012 and 2013, whether there'd be a violent clash between China and Japan and the East China Sea. Questions of a wide range all over the world, and some of them pretty complicated and esoteric. But the extraordinary thing was how many talented amateurs did a good job in those tournaments between 2011 and 2015.
Do they sometimes beat the experts?
Yes, they did.
And why do you think that is?
I think you're likely to do better at this if you take it seriously. If you're an expert and you get a lot of status for saying, I think there's a distinct possibility of Putin's going to invade Estonia, if that's a comfortable status quo for you and people don't push you very hard and you make a good living and you're never wrong because you can see you're covered on both sides of maybe quite comfortably, you have very few incentives, I think, to cultivate forecasting as a skill. The people who really rose in the IARPA, the intelligence community forecasting tournaments, tended to be amateurs. They tended to be outsiders who were curious how good it was possible to get.
I'm speaking with Philip E. Tetlock, who, with Dan Gardner, has written Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. It was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover and now available in paperback from Broadway Books. And you said to me before we went on the air that the book's widest audience was in the executive suites, not in the areas that we might have expected, like discussions of politics, because those are the people who need to be able to predict best where business is going. Every so often I receive something from some expert who says, food trends for 2017, what we will be eating. Fashion trends for 2017, what we will be wearing. Is that all part of the same process? Yeah.
Well, it is to some degree. I think senior people in organizations, muckety-mucks, tend to be interested in forecasting tournaments because they have the money and the power to implement them inside their organizations. So the U.S. intelligence community has thousands of analysts making judgments on tens of thousands of topics. And you can collect a lot of information, and you can make the statistical law of large numbers work for you. Similarly, large organizations like banks and other entities have a lot of personnel whose job it is to monitor trends. So naturally, the accuracy of all these people becomes something of real interest.
But can we even predict something like like ISIS? Until ISIS comes along, could we have even thought that it might occur?
Or could we have predicted Al-Qaeda before that? Or is how radically different is ISIS from Al-Qaeda?
Or could we have predicted what happened in Libya as opposed to what happened in Algeria or Tunisia?
Right, right. And these are extremely hard things to do. And here's the short answer. The short answer
I'm going to predict that Putin is not going to invade Estonia.
zero probability on that.
No, not zero, but it's unlikely.
Okay, we got to narrow that down a little bit more. But I think what we want to say is it's not that things are unpredictable or they're predictable. They're predictable to varying degrees in different situations, and you have to learn to become nuanced. So if we were talking about poker, for example, a great poker player once said that you could tell the difference between great poker players and talented amateurs because the great players know the difference between 60-40 bets and 40-60 bets. And then he paused and said, no, more like 55-45, 45-55. Maybe sometimes 52-48, 48-52. Now, poker is a game in which all the basic laws of statistics that you learned in your stat class apply. You're sampling from a well-defined universe, repeated play, quick feedback on whether you're right or wrong. The world isn't as clean as poker, so you're not likely to be able to make 52-48 discriminations. But we do know from the forecasting tournaments that you can do a lot better than yes, no, maybe.
Well, if we look to science fiction, which to some degree is all about forecasting, it's right some of the time, and it's totally wrong some of the time as well. Then things occur that nobody could have predicted. That's why I mentioned ISIS. But you couldn't predict an earthquake, for example, changing a country's course of history.
Right, right.
So yet we have lots of people in this business.
We do. Earthquakes are interesting in and of themselves, not just as metaphors. I mean, we can't do a very good job of predicting when and where and to what magnitude earthquakes will be. And that's true, even though the science, underlying science of geophysics, plate tectonics and all that, is very, very robust. So we have a good understanding of the causal mechanisms that produce earthquakes, but that doesn't translate into a good capacity to predict. And I think that can happen in politics as well. I think we knew there was a lot of instability in the Arab world. There's a lot of corruption. There was a huge bulge of unemployed youth. There's a lot of disaffection. You could say it was kind of like a very dry forest, and someone's eventually going to throw a match into the... Yeah.
Well, when the Pentagon forecasts events like Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, don't they prepare for several possible outcomes with different possibilities?
And they certainly should.
My guest is Philip E. Tetlock. His book, Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, is now available in paperback from Broadway Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Philip E. Tetlock, who, with Dan Gardner, has written Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, now available in paperback from Broadway, the follow-up to a another work of years of research from 2005 called Expert Political Judgment. Is this a perfect follow-up to that?
It's a much higher budget follow-up. I started doing forecasting tournaments a long time ago. Hard to talk about this topic without revealing how old I am. So the first forecasting tournaments I started running were back in 1984 when Mikhail Gorbachev was still a junior member of the Politburo. And, the book you're referring to, Expert Political Judgment, came out in 2005, and Gorbachev went to becoming one of the most important political figures in 20th century history, to being a relatively anonymous pensioner in Moscow doing occasional commercials for Pizza Hut.
Mm-hmm. We just had the debates and the political debates, and many people predicted what would happen before each of them, and they turned out to be quite different from what had been predicted. Have you done any tournaments, forecasting tournaments, about how the debates work?
Are you referring to the impact of the debates on public opinion?
I know you had forecasting tournaments regarding debates. What were you asking about? What were you looking into?
One of the things where we've been interested in doing is using forecasting tournaments to make political debates more civilized.
Didn't do a good job this last time.
Well, yeah, the 2016 election is not going to—we don't want to take responsibility for that. But we do it. We're operating on a much smaller scale than that. And the idea is you get people who have competing positions on an issue. Say we did something in New York Times on this in 2015 on the controversy surrounding the deal over the Iranian nuclear program, where you had hawks and you had doves. And the hawks were saying, look, you're just basically giving them a carte blanche to develop a bomb. And the doves are saying this is by far the best way to contain the Iranian nuclear program and keep things peaceful. And
are they both looking at the exact same information, all the same data?
As usual. they're looking at the same data, but they're putting very different emphasis on certain facts. So one of the ways of making it more civilized is to put the pundits' feet to the fire and ask them to make predictions about what's likely to happen in the next 6 to 12 to 18 to 24 months. And each side gets to nominate questions that it thinks the other side is going to have a hard time answering. So if I'm a hawk, I think you're going to have a hard time answering questions about whether the Atomic Energy Commission is going to be allowed access to everything. And if you're a dove, you're going to think I'm going to have a hard time answering some questions about political change in Iran or whatever it might be. Each side thinks it has some advantage. So each side gets to pose questions in the tournament where it thinks it has an advantage. And then everybody has to ante up with their probability judgments. Now, in this kind of a situation, it's actually possible to lose, right? You not only fail to answer the other side's questions better, you fail to answer your own questions better. A stalemate is where each side can answer its own questions better.
Now, college debaters probably do a lot better than politicians.
You know, college debate is an interesting thing. It encourages a lot of gamesmanship and trickery and sophistry, I think. I think some of the people who judge debates can see through that stuff. But I think a lot of the techniques we reward in debate are stylistic. And we would be better off as a society if we tried to become just a bit more scientific in how we judge judgment.
What is the super forecasting of your title? How is it different from regular forecasting or predicting?
The key thing here is running forecasting tournaments, tracking the accuracy of thousands of people on hundreds of questions over years, and finding the top performers and making sure the top performers don't simply regress back toward the mean, the way star athletes sometimes do. Now, no one's going to be a super forecaster every year forever, but some people are consistently better performers. And if you wanted to, you should put your money on them. And I think you'll be better off from a business point of view, and you'll be better off from the standpoint of governance.
How did the desires or preferences of the forecaster affect his or her approach to forecasting? And can those preferences be nudged with incentives of some kind or other?
We find that the best forecasters are very good at putting aside whether they're liberal or conservative on an issue. Two completely separate issues are whether I want Hillary Clinton to win and how likely do I think it is Hillary Clinton's going to win. One is a probability judgment. The other is a desirability judgment. And people do often blur them together. We often get into wishful thinking. And I think you'd have to be, if you were a Trump supporter, you'd have to be capable of really massively wishful thinking to suppose Trump is going to win at this point. But in elections that are closer calls, wishful thinking is the norm. I mean, Romney supporters were bitterly disappointed because it was a closer election.
And we saw Karl Rove on television surprised after the election was called for Obama. He didn't want to believe it.
Right.
Although Karl Rove is now predicting that Hillary Clinton will win this election.
I don't think he's going too much out on a limb on that.
You discuss a distinction the philosopher Isaiah Berlin made between the fox and the hedgehog. The fox and the hedgehog?
Right. Yeah, so that comes from a line of poetry that survived 2,500 years. The Greek warrior poet Archilochus, who is quoted as having written that the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. So the hedgehogs are people who have one big animating political idea. They might be Marxists, they might be libertarians, they might be environmental doomsters, they might be environmental boomsters. They might be bulls, they might be bears, but they're animated by a big idea. And the foxes make more complex, cautious, contingent forecasts that take more factors into account.
Are experts in a place like the Defense Department or working for a liberal or conservative media company under pressure to come to certain conclusions?
I think the pressure that I see that we saw working in the earlier tournaments was interesting. There was a tendency for the more famous pundits to be less accurate in forecasting tournaments. And I think part of the mechanism at work here is that the media put a lot of pressure on the people they interview to come up with pithy, compelling sound bites. And it's easier to do sound bites if you're a hedgehog than if you're a fox. If you're a fox, you're more likely to sound like, on the one hand, on the other hand. If you're a hedgehog, you're more likely to sound this, moreover this.
My guess is Philip E. Tetlock, his latest book, written with Dan Gardner, his Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, now available in a paperback edition from Broadway Books. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How do human super forecasters do compared to supercomputers?
What an interesting question. That is that's a very important part of the future.
And we're relying more and more on computers to do that kind of forecasting.
Oh, that is certainly part of it. It's a safe prediction that that's an integral part of the future. And the U.S. intelligence community, which sponsored the human forecasting tournaments, has announced competition now among universities engage in what they call a hybrid forecasting competition, in which the goal is to put together the best human-machine combinations for generating accurate probability judgments. So this is a huge challenge, and I stay tuned.
You write about someone named Bill Flack. He was pretty good just working solo.
Bill Flack, right. A Cornhusker from Nebraska. Bill Flack was one of the very best forecasters in the forecasting tournaments between 2011 and 2015. A humble, witty, thoughtful, anonymous character, at least anonymous until the book came out. What we did at the beginning of the book is we compared Bill Flack, who is so unknown, but has a very well-documented forecasting record, with some very famous pundits who are extremely well-known and whose forecasting track records are totally unknown.
Does Bill Flack do it all alone? Wouldn't forecasting be better if there was some collaboration involved?
There is. The best forecasters in the intelligence community forecasting tournaments were brought together into teams of so-called super forecasters, or brought into super teams, in which they're able to divide up the labor and challenge each other. A lot of people thought it was a bad idea to put them in teams because they thought teams would be prone to groupthink and all the stuff that goes wrong in teams. It was interesting that the super forecasters proved to be as good team players as they were. They managed for the most part to, they learned how to disagree without being disagreeable.
Well, if they can all be like the conglomerate Fox, each with a certain area of expertise, then they, if they can come to some kind of consensus, then I would assume they would have done a better job than some than just one person.
That's correct.
From time to time, we hear about the knitting circles that do better at investing than Wall Street hedge funds. Have you studied any existing amateur forecasting groups like those, or are they purely fictional, like the people who throw darts at the stock market reports and wind up investing better than the experts?
Well, stock market prediction is the holy grail of forecasting, and of course, there are some very influential economists. There's a battalion of Nobel Prize-winning economists who believe in versions of the efficient markets hypothesis, which essentially tells us that it's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for individuals to do better than the stock market, and that you're better off putting your money into index funds like Vanguard.
Your title refers to the science and the art of prediction. Where's the art?
That comes back to this issue of humans and machines, and where do machines do better and where do humans do better? Machines do better where you have big data, where you have lots of good statistics. It's very hard, for example, to beat machine models in sports prediction now because it's so well documented. But when you get into predicting more idiosyncratic human affairs, like, who is Hillary Clinton going to appoint for her cabinet? Things that have to do with peculiarities of human beings still, I think, have a distinctive advantage there.
All of the predictions of the vice presidential candidates turned out to not be true, at least the ones that I remember. Neither Kane nor Pence were at the top of either list.
Right. They probably appeared on the list, though, somewhere.
Are there competing approaches to forecasting? For example, isn't there a technique called the Delphi method?
The Delphi method is one of my favorite methods for improving team decision-making, and it's a powerful method, and we've been very interested in it. Here's the idea. Usually in a meeting in an organization, the boss comes in and says, I think we should follow strategy X here. And then he turns to some of his subordinates around the table and says, what do you think, Jim? What do you think, Sue? And so forth. This is a way of getting an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees with the boss.
Right. So what Delphi is about is everybody does their homework before they come into the meeting, and everybody before the meeting writes down, say, I prefer strategy X, Y, or Z, and here are the reasons why I prefer that strategy. And they circulate. Each person's explanation gets circulated to everybody else, and nobody knows who wrote it. So nobody knows that the boss said, "I like X, and I like X because of this." It's just one of the pieces of paper among many pieces of paper that people are integrating, and then everybody makes another judgment after they've been exposed to all of the information, and they do that a couple of times until they move toward convergence. A couple of things about this: A, it's faster than most meetings, and B, it improves accuracy in a statistically significant way. So it's a cheap and proven way of improving the quality of group decision making and of forecasting.
You launched something called Good Judgment Project, and we have a link to it on our show page. What has that project aimed to do?
Well, the Good Judgment Project was the research team that won the forecasting tournaments from 2011 to 2015. And it consists of a group of investigators, including my wife, Barbara Mellers, who's also a professor at University of Pennsylvania, was co-principal investigator with me on the project. So it was a research group, a research team, that continues to exist.
The director of National Intelligence formed the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects activity. It's kind of like the Department of Defense's DARPA. Is it applying your research?
Well, IARPA doesn't actually do intelligence analysis. They're a research organization. So they have to persuade the people inside the CIA and the DIA and all that other alphabet soup of intelligence agencies. They have to persuade those people to adopt their ideas. I think the short answer is that there's been more widespread adoption of this research than virtually any other research that they've been involved in.
Your Good Judgment website has questions about foreign events like elections in Palestine. Do forecasters approach questions differently when the subject is far away as opposed to something in their own backyards?
You've got conflicting forces at work. On the one hand, you know more about what's in your own backyard. On the other hand, you have more emotional distortion at work. So it turns out you're not really much more accurate in your own backyard than you are far away, assuming you do some basic homework on the faraway questions.
Didn't you also launch a commercial venture called Good Judgment Incorporated?
That organization is run by the woman who is in charge of the Good Judgment Project, Terry Murray. And it does indeed work with a number of government agencies and with private organizations in improving forecasting.
In many environments, including political and corporate ones, can't a good judgment hurt your career if, as you talked about earlier, you disagree with your superiors?
Right. Well, it's an interesting test of your boss.
And we also hate the guy who said, I told you so.
I mean, what kind of a boss do you have? Do you have a boss who would be pleased or who would be unhappy to learn that he or she is not the best forecaster in the room?
Hmm.
The bosses who would be displeased will be the bosses who will look at the idea of running a forecasting tournament and go thumbs down. It takes an unusually open, non-defensive boss to be open to doing something like this. Because, look, if you have the status in an organization, there's kind of a presumption you must know what you're doing. So why would you want to play a game in which the best possible outcome you can have would be a tie? You could vindicate your status. That's the best possible outcome. The more likely outcome is you're going to lose some status to some degree.
Philip E. Tetlock, T-E-T-L-O-C-K, is co-author with Dan Gardner of Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. It is published now in paperback by Broadway Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.